Last week, when we began our series looking at the letters to the churches in Revelation, we started off by looking at some figures that had been gathered by the Scottish Church Census, and what we noted was that attendance in Scottish churches had been falling, so it wasn't a particularly positive start last week. But this week I do want to start by sharing with you something that is more positive, because although the situation in Scotland looks quite difficult, quite bleak in some ways, globally, Christianity continues to have the most followers. It's estimated that there are approximately 2.4 billion Christians in our world. And while that is an encouraging figure, we do need to be careful with that statistic. It's very difficult to verify exactly how many Christians there are. And equally, the figure doesn't make any distinction between those who are churchgoers and those who truly do believe the gospel of Jesus Christ. But not only does Christianity have the most followers around the world, it also continues to grow. The Christian faith continues to attract new believers each day. And church growth is seen especially in places like Asia, Africa, and South America. Indeed, in 1900, it was estimated there were only 9 million Christians in the whole of Africa. And today, that figure sits at 541 million. And church growth in Africa has seen, in the last 15 years, it's grown by 51%. Over 15 years, the church in Africa has grown by over half of what it was 15 years ago. That's incredible levels of growth. And it's encouraging to know that although the situation for us may be difficult, it's not the case across our world. But I think it forces us in this country, in this context, to ask ourselves, why is it that the church tends to be growing in places that aren't the West, as in Europe, North America, that sort of context? Well, I would think that the reason for this is that because generally, and this is a generalization, if you live in the West, you have a job that gives you economic stability, a car which gives you a sense of independence, a home which gives you some sense of safety, and leisure time in which you can pursue whatever takes your fancy. If you want to collect stamps or do a garden or climb hills, you can do that in your leisure time. And so with that, a job, a car, a home, and time to do what I want, why do I need God? There's no need for God in that comfortable lifestyle because I've got everything made for me. And indeed, that's one of the challenges that faces us in particular as a congregation, because what I have described, a person with a job, a car, a home, and leisure time, that accounts for approximately half of our parish. Half of the people that live in our parish fit that description. Half the people in our parish wonder, why do I need God when I've got all of these other things? And so the challenge for us as a church is to try and demonstrate and communicate, actually, you do need God if you want to be able to live life to the full. But take that generalized view of someone living in the West and compare it again to a generalized view of someone living in somewhere like Africa or Asia or South America. Here you are less likely to have a comfortable lifestyle as we in the West would understand it. You're more likely to face hardship and difficulty. You are likely to be living in a more vulnerable situation. And so in that context where you maybe don't have worldly comforts, the message of the gospel is hugely powerful because the message of the gospel says you have a safe and dependable God. You have a God who will love and protect you. You have a God who has given you a place in his kingdom through Jesus Christ, and this place gives you hope beyond the life that you are currently living. If you communicate that to someone who doesn't have comforts in this world, it's a hugely powerful message. It grabs attention. It says maybe there is more to life than this. It's that kind of context that was the experience of the church in Smyrna. They were a church who were facing hardship and difficulty. They were a church facing poverty. They were a church who were in a vulnerable situation. And so Jesus writes to them, he addresses them and gives them hope, gives them a vision for their future. And this is the letter we'll consider this morning. This is, by the way, the shortest of the letters in Revelation. It is only 4 verses long, and yet, what a vision of hope it offers to the church in Smyrna and to us today. So the church in Smyrna, the persecuted church. In terms of the city of Smyrna, we have another large city. It is not the capital city, as we will see in weeks to come, but it's a large city. It's a large city that is important in terms of the economics of the region. Smyrna was a harbor city. It sat at the end of a well-protected gulf, and you can even think of the history of our own city here in Glasgow. So often throughout time, cities grew up around harbors where commerce was the important thing. Glasgow grew up around the River Clyde. Smyrna grew up around a gulf in that region. It was a city that was destroyed in 580 BC, but was rebuilt around 290 BC, and it was rebuilt following a comprehensive plan. And the best image I could think of to communicate that to you is, think like East Kilbride, but with fewer roundabouts. East Kilbride was a town that was built to a plan, and they built it all at once. Smyrna was the same. It was destroyed. It was a blank canvas, and the builders came in with a very particular plan, and they rebuilt that city. Smyrna was also one of the first cities in the region to worship the Roman emperor. Indeed, this city supported the Romans long before Rome took control of this region. So for the Roman authorities who are now in charge of the region, Smyrna had a lot going in their favor because they'd stood on the side of the Romans. And so I share that context with you because we see that there are some major similarities between Ephesus that we looked at last week and Smyrna this week. But there is one major difference between these two cities. The church in Smyrna were being given a much harder time. Although the economic context was similar, the geographic context was similar, even the Roman context was similar. In Ephesus, the church were getting off light. But in Smyrna, the church was facing great hardship and great difficulty. And so Jesus comes to this church in this city. He comes to them and says that he is the one who is first and last, the one who died and came back to life. I noted that it's interesting that Jesus chooses that way of communicating to Smyrna. He says, once I was dead, now I'm back to life. He says that to a city which in itself was once dead and had been brought back to life. And so if you were a local in Smyrna, if you were one of the people that had grown up there, you knew the history of the city you lived in, you came to faith in Jesus and you received this letter, you'd think, I get what Jesus means. Because that's what the same as what happened to our city. It was dead and is now back to life. This description of Jesus says something of the authority that he has. He existed before all things and he will endure beyond all things, being the first and the last. And it suggests to us that Jesus' authority and dominion are eternal, and that everything that is temporal, i.e. that has a beginning and an end, is under his control, his authority. But his authority also extends to being over death, because once he was dead and then he came back to life, and therefore death has no control over this Jesus that is writing the letter. And indeed, the fact that Jesus has authority over death is something which, as we will see, is hugely important to this church. Hugely important to them. This is only one of 2 letters where Jesus actually doesn't have any criticism of the church. He's got nothing bad to say about them. It's all fairly positive toward the church, although the context of that church is a difficult one. Jesus writes to this church and he says he knows of their afflictions, he knows of their troubles, he knows what they are experiencing and what they are going through. And incidentally, that is another powerful aspect of the Christian message, to be able to say with certainty that Jesus knows what we are going through in this world, that he understands it. Not just that he sympathizes, but he actually gets what we're experiencing. What a powerful thing to say. What a powerful reality to know that the God of the universe understands where you are. Hugely important, especially for those who face hardship and difficulty. The hardship faced by Smyrna was firstly poverty. The poverty faced by the Christians in Smyrna was severe, and on this Leon Morris comments, many think that the Smyrnaeans' poverty was in part due to pillage of their goods by the Jews. Christianity was not legally permitted, which made it easy for Jews or pagans to take action against believers. It's one of the great difficulties in admitting to being a follower of Jesus in this time when these letters were written. You opened yourself up to all sorts of assaults, all sorts of difficulties, because it wasn't legally recognized by anyone. Not by the Romans, not by the Jews. And so if someone came along and they liked the look of your cart or your donkey or any other possession that you had, there was no law against just clocking the Christian and making off with their stuff. And the heartbreaking thing is that that happens in our world today. In some of the countries where persecution is at its worst, that still happens. If you say, I am a follower of Jesus Christ, there are people that will come and say, I quite like the look of your car, or your home, or your wife, or your kids, and they'll just take them away. And yet there were people willing to be faithful, willing, still willing, to stand up and say, we follow Jesus, despite the notion that this could happen. There are still people today, despite knowing that they are putting themselves at great personal risk, will say, I follow Jesus Christ, because their faith in Christ is much more important to them than their stuff. And we'll see later in this letter what it is about faith in Jesus that enables them to continue to believe that, even although they put themselves at great risk. Part of the issue, as the quote I've read suggests, is there was tension between the Jews and the Christians in Smyrna, and certainly Jesus himself picks up on that. He says that there are Jews in Smyrna who claim they are Jews, but in reality are not, and that they are slandering, they are saying evil things about the Christians in Smyrna. In fact, in some translations of the Bible, what Jesus actually says is not that they belong to Satan. He says they are a synagogue of Satan. A synagogue of Satan. And that, I think, is an expression which requires a bit of explanation. We need to bear in mind that Satan, although we use that word synonymously to mean the devil, Satan simply means accuser, one who accuses. So when Jesus refers to the Jews as being of Satan, what he means is that the Jews are accusing Christians of something. Now, there was a rather curious situation in the Roman Empire, because for some reason Rome decided to take pity on the Jews, and they allowed the Jews freedom to continue to worship their God, and they didn't force the Jews to participate in the worship of the emperor, in the same way that they forced other ethnic groups to worship the emperor. Jews were exempt from worshiping the emperor. I think I'm right in saying they were the only group that were exempt. And so early Christians came along, they believed in Jesus, but it's important we realize, although we call ourselves Christians today, back when these letters were written, the church did not see itself as being any different from the Jewish faith. To the Christians' mind, they were still Jews. It's simply that they believed the Messiah had come in Jesus Christ. So as far as they were concerned, they were still part of the Jewish faith. They were a continuation of that faith, and therefore, they should also be exempt from worshipping the emperor. They shouldn't be forced to pay homage to a man in Rome who also claimed to be Son of God, for they believed in the true Son of God, Jesus. Now, unfortunately, the Jews did not see things that way. And so instead, they would accuse the Christians of not being true Jews. They would accuse them to the Roman authorities. They would say, they're not part of our group. And so the Romans would come along and would believe those Jewish accusers, and so would force the Christians to participate in emperor worship and punish or kill any who refused. And so when Jesus talks about the Jews belonging to Satan, being a synagogue of Satan, what he means is they are accusing Christians in such a way that it is causing them pain, hardship, and even death. The ironic thing, I think, is that after Jesus' death and resurrection, to be a true Jew was to believe in him. If you're a Jew, you're a follower of the one true God. To be a follower of the one true God after Jesus' death and resurrection is to believe in Jesus Christ. The irony here, the Jewish people were accusing the Christians of not being true Jews, and yet it was the Christians who were much truer Jews than the Jews were, because they believed in the true Messiah. They believed that he had died for sin. They believed he had risen again, proclaiming new life for the faithful. They followed his teachings. They proclaimed the gospel. They were the true Jews. That's the irony of their accusations. That is also the affliction of the church in Smyrna, the poverty and the slander. But Jesus offers them encouragement. He shares something with them that will help them to endure through the suffering that they are experiencing for their faith. Jesus firstly warns the church. He says that the devil is going to test them. He's going to have some of them imprisoned. Some are going to be persecuted. But that this will happen for 10 days. Now, looking into that reference to 10 days, it's unclear what Jesus meant when he said that, but certainly there seems to be a consensus that it's not a literal 10 days, unfortunately. It's not as though the church in Smyrna would suffer for 10 days and then all would be rosy and well. 10 days of suffering would actually be quite light compared to what truly happens to some who believe in Jesus. What does seem to be clear, though, is that because Jesus says this will last for 10 days, what he is trying to communicate is that there will be an end to their suffering. It will last for a certain period of time. It is not going to be an eternal suffering. It may last for a long time, but it won't last forever. There's a definite end. Could be 10 days, weeks, months, years, however long it is, but there is definitely going to be an end. And indeed, this idea of the end of suffering is something that is picked up throughout the book of Revelation and reaches its climax toward the end of the book, where we have that vision of the new heaven and the new earth, where God says all the pain and suffering of this world have ended, for they have passed away. There is a definite end to suffering. It may not be in this life, but it is certainly in the next. While the suffering is ended and Jesus seems to give that promise to the Smyrnaean Christians, there's a sense as well that it will still impact them. Jesus calls on them to be faithful to the point of death. And that suggests that some of them are going to have to die for their faith. Some of them are perhaps going to be crucified, fed to lions. These were the sorts of things that the Romans did. And yet Jesus promises them, he says, for those of you who are faithful to me, who manage to sustain your faith, even to the point of death, The Good News Bible says that they will be given as a prize. They will be given their prize of victory. The NIV translates it slightly differently, and I do prefer this one. For Jesus says, in the way it's rendered in the NIV, they will be given a crown of victory. Not just a prize, a crown. Jesus offers this to them, and it's almost in a sense that what he's saying is similar to a parable that he told where he said, "Well done, my good and faithful servant." There's a real sense that he calls on the church, even if you're going to die, be faithful to me. Be faithful to me, because if you are, there is a crown waiting for you, and I'm going to be the one that puts it on your head. I'm going to be the one that gives it to you as a way of saying, "Well done. You did it. You did what I asked of you. You were faithful to me. And because of your faith, have a crown." The highest of honors that can be bestowed upon any person is to have a crown laid upon their head. It says something of royalty, of status. It's God's way of saying, "I value you so much that when you come into my presence, I'm going to give you the crown." What a tremendous thing for us. What a hope that is for the persecuted church and for this church. The future that we have in God's presence involves a crown being placed on our head. Part of this reward as well is Jesus trying to communicate something that I have said before. I know I have. If you're a Christian and someone comes along and says to you, "If you don't renounce your faith, I'm going to kill you," what do you do? What do you do? Do you renounce your faith and continue living in this life? You know, you could renounce it with your fingers crossed behind your back. You don't really mean it. Or do you say, "Do you know what? I believe in Jesus Christ. I have faith in him. And so if you want to kill me for that, go ahead. But if you do, all you will succeed in doing is speeding my way to my Father in heaven." It's why the Christian message is so feared by dictators and by those that would use violence to control people. Because the Christian message says that actually, do you know what? You can do anything you want to me in this world. You can insult me. You can imprison me. You can even kill me. It does not matter, because whatever you do to me, my place with my Father in heaven is secure. And even if you decide to kill me, all you are doing is succeeding in sending me to his presence a lot sooner than I would perhaps have expected. And so Jesus encourages the church in Smyrna, if that's going to happen to you, if you're going to have to die for your faith, all they succeed in doing is allowing me to put that crown on your head sooner. All they succeed in doing is bringing you to me a lot sooner than you may have thought. That's all they've managed to do. It's why so many in countries where there is persecution and oppression and violence cling so hard to the Christian faith, because it gives them that assurance of their future, that even through the hardships of this world, there is hope for them in the next. Finally, Jesus talks, as he does at the end of every letter, about those who are victorious, about what the victor, those who win the victory, will receive. And in this one, he says something rather curious. He says that those who are victorious will not be hurt by the second death. They will not be harmed by the second death. And it's a curious phrase, and it's one that we actually need to read further into the book of Revelation to understand, because in Revelation chapter 20, we read that then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. The lake of fire is the second death. Anyone whose name was not written in the book of life was thrown into the lake of fire. That's the explanation of the second death. It is a lake of fire, and it is from that image, that those verses, that we have constructed the what we would commonly call hell. Hell is the opposite to eternal life. You could call it eternal punishment or eternal death. And it is the consequence for those whose names are not written in the book of life. Namely, it is the consequence for those who throughout their life, despite God's attempts to show them his love, to declare his gospel to them, have continually and absolutely rejected God in every way. And some people may ask the question, is hell fair? Is it fair for God to send people to this second death, this place of punishment? Is it not fairer for God simply to love and to bring everyone to him? And my response to that is it really fair for God to force himself upon a person if they have chosen to reject him all their lives? If you want nothing to do with God, is it really fair of him to force himself upon you? I don't think it is. Now, I will say this, I take no pleasure in speaking of this subject of hell, and nor should I, nor should anyone. It is an unpleasant reality. The reason our world is in the state that it is because we are separated from God. And so how much worse is it in this second death that people will be separated from him for all of eternity? And yet I believe we need to appreciate, despite the fact that it is an uncomfortable subject, we must appreciate why there is such a thing as a second death. We are separated from God through our own choice. We chose it, so we must bear the consequences of our rejection of him. God, wanting to free us from these consequences, sent Jesus. Jesus took the punishment of our rejection upon himself, thus freeing us and enabling us to come back to God. And so in our lives, if we do not admit that we need Jesus Christ, if we do not admit that we have put our faith in him, then there is only one person who can deal with the consequences of your rejection, and that is you. If you don't allow Jesus to deal with the consequences, you have to deal with them. And that is why Jesus is saying to the church in Smyrna, if you believe in me, I can give you certainty that you will not be harmed by the second death because I've taken the punishment for you. If you continue to have faith in me, you will win the victory and you won't be harmed by the second death because I've dealt with it. What we see here is an encouragement to the persecuted church, an encouragement that says, you may well be hurt by death in this world, but if you believe in Jesus, you will not be harmed by the second death. But we in turn are also given a powerful motive to share the gospel. We don't want anyone to be harmed by the second death. We don't want people to be separated from God. We want people to love God. We want people to experience the joy, the peace that comes from loving God. And so we share our faith in the hope that by doing so, we will add to the number who will not be harmed by the second death. From this letter to the church in Smyrna, I think there are two things to take away. The first is aimed primarily at the persecuted church. Jesus gives words of encouragement to stick strongly to their faith and to persevere. There's an assurance that the suffering of the persecuted church is not in vain. Their faithfulness is a witness to the world, and it will be rewarded in the next. They will be crowned victors. And although they may suffer death in this world, they have nothing to fear from the second death. The second thing to take away is primarily aimed at us. This letter gives us a sincere motive for wanting people to come to faith in Jesus, to avoid that second death. It should be our desire that all people come to saving faith in Jesus Christ, and our whole work as a church should be geared toward getting the gospel out there. And further to this is an added challenge in our context. With little persecution, we should strive to show people that God is necessary for a fulfilled life. Life is more than work, money, and play. We live life to its fullest when we live for and love God. And so we have a responsibility as a church to show others around us what it is like to live and to love God. So let us get out there and let us show our world. Amen, and thanks be to God for this letter to the church in Smyrna.